Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And it was just an oldish and quite an old rundown house in Punchbowl. Renovated it a bit and rented it out. And I really had no interest because I guess at that point in my life, I was just wanting to have fun, go out. I didn't want to have a mortgage, a debt at that point. So in a way, my start in property investment was very reluctant and had to be pushed.
This is Property Investory, where we talk to successful property investors to find out more about their stories, mindset, and strategies. I'm Tarun Shum, and in this episode, we're speaking with Chi Lam, devoted husband, father, director, and founder of his own company. His earliest memories are something most of us can't even imagine, which is to escape from Vietnam as refugees on a small boat. But using his resilience and strength, he came out the other end all the better for it. Chi Lam is the embodiment of having your cake and eating it too. However, that's not to say he hasn't overcome his fair share of challenges. His childhood was less than perfect and contained some harrowing experiences many of us could never dream of. Today, he runs a business and is a full-time hands-on dad to his kids, proving you really can have it all.
My title at the moment is a director of a company that I founded. That was the side business, which was originally a side hustle. And now it's pretty much my full-time thing, although my time during the week is split into various things. I'm the primary carer of my girls. I've got two girls, so I'm the one that picks them up from school, drops them off, take them to after school activities and all that sort of stuff. So my wife works full time. So my time's very much split as to what's needed. The business has its, it's a case of how much time I can put into it is what I get back. So, and there's no, 9 to 5 with the business. So it's just, obviously when orders come in, I have to deal with those fairly quickly. But apart from that, yeah, the time's very flexible. And that's one of the advantages, I guess, of what I've currently got going.
Thanks to his unconventional approach to work and family, no 2 days ever look the same for Lam.
There's no real typical day, as I say. But, generally speaking, since I'm the one that drops the kids off, I need to get them ready. So get them ready in the morning. I'm focused on fitness these days and personal health. So after that, I might do a bit of work to kind of catch up on any sort of urgent sort of work with the business. Then I go and I do a bit of yoga or some gym work, and then usually get back into sort of more business stuff until and depending on the day, I might go and play some touch footy with some friends of mine, ex workmates of mine. Yep, so I like to stay active. Yeah, around lunchtime. We have a local touch footy gathering every Tuesdays and Fridays. So if the weather's good and we get enough people, we all just rock up at a field in Bella Vista and just play some touch footy. It's fantastic. It gets the blood pumping and we all really look forward to it. And then after that, it's just either a bit more work and then picking them up after school activities, dinner, and that's generally the kind of the school week. And when it's school holidays, it's completely random. It could be whatever. The business and all and kind of work takes a backseat during school holidays. So it's a lot of the case. It's just if we've arranged play dates with their friends, or then I need to be there, or I need to take them there, whatever. Or the kids come over. I need to supervise. it's all a mixed bag when it comes to school holidays.
Lam was born and raised in Vietnam for the first 6 years of his life. Those formative years coincided with some of Australia's darkest times and ultimately saw his family make the decision to leave the country.
I still have, I guess, you know, some memories of it. And then we escaped Vietnam communism, I guess, after the war as boat refugees and spent about it was quite a treacherous sort of 5-day boat journey. And we eventually got to Malaysia, where we spent about a year in the refugee camp in Malaysia. So I've got memories of that as well.
Can we talk a little bit about that? So first 6 years when you were born in Vietnam, because you would have been quite young. It's amazing that you remember a lot of that. Can you just explain to us, like, what was the feeling when you were actually, you know, having to have to leave Vietnam because of the war? Like,
I was quite young, right? So I was six, and I wouldn't say I have a lot of memories of it. It's more moments of, and in particular, kind of the journey, maybe because it was quite impactful even at that age. How did I feel at that age? Like, you know, as a kid, you're a passenger in life type thing. You get carried along, you know, your parents take you wherever they want and you just along for the ride. But I do remember things like, leaving the country in the middle of the night, going out into somewhere pitch black on bicycles and kind of or scooters. I don't remember exactly. Getting on into a dinghy out to the bigger sort of fishing boat, which is the vessel that we eventually came out of, left Vietnam with in. it was kind of like your typical fishing vessel that you see, when you see news articles of boat people coming to Australia. Everyone was crammed into the hull. I remember all that. I remember a fair bit about the trip, actually. So it must have been quite, I guess, traumatic for me to remember some of that. Remembering how squishy, how hot, the smell of diesel, nausea because I was seasick. And I think I was actually also ill from some sort of cold or flu or whatever for most of that journey, actually. So I remember things like, you know, the waves, the crazy big waves, and being a naive little six-year-old, I was asking mum, why are the waves so big, or something like that, something along those lines. And and, you know, I can imagine that for the adults, they must have been terrified. Like, it's if the ocean, you know, you've seen how big the ocean can be, and you're in this little 11-12 meter fishing vessel that, yeah, just getting sloshed about.
Do you remember asking mum and dad why you're on this vessel?
I don't remember I don't remember asking them that, but it's more of a, I don't know. As kids, maybe you just don't question that. I do remember being scared, which is the weird thing. Like, that's probably the first memory of being, it's almost like, I don't know if it's too young to even make, to have these feelings of being scared for your life, if that's even possible at the age of six. Yeah. Like, it's like, you're just scared because you know this is not right. But I guess as a kid, you know, kind of, yeah, it, the memories is just kind of fleeting, I guess. It's just, yeah, I have memories of moments. The memories in Vietnam were just, some of them were just like quite nice, quite good. You know, I remember I had like a little Bruce Lee toy, balloons. I remember that place kind of roughly where we lived. And as a child, geez, our house in Vietnam, felt so big, but when I went back there many years later, it's like tiny. So I've got just little memories of my life back in Vietnam. It was quite, you know, it was quite nice. But yeah, the journey, the refugee journey was quite harrowing, I guess.
The trip from Vietnam to Malaysia took about 5 days, and although Lam's memory of it are hazy, the trip made a huge impact on his family.
It was pretty rough on everyone on the ship because, I think things like food was rationed, water was rationed. It's a case of you don't really know how long, they kind of do, but you always prepare for the worst just in case there's not enough. You know, if you get lost at sea, you don't know how long the food or the water's going to last. I don't know when we got attacked by the pirates. But I think at some initially it started as contact with some boats. This is what mum told me. Okay, so I think she said that there were initially boats which then contacted us and then realize that we were not, that we were refugees, and we were, I guess, easy targets for the, I believe they were Thailand fishermen, who kind of, you know, it was probably more profitable to rob refugees than to fish at that time, because there were a lot of refugees doing what we were doing, you know, paying to escape the country and kind of carrying with them as much gold or US dollars or whatever that you can kind of liquidate in Vietnam without raising suspicion, because you don't want to be, because, you know, the government wouldn't let you leave, obviously, and they would capture you. And I think we had a failed attempt earlier on too, because I remember not one time we tried to go, and it's we came back in the middle of the night, kind of went on a journey to nowhere. And as a kid, I probably asked my mum, what, like, you know, I remember what was going on there. Well, why did we come back? I thought we were going somewhere. But I think that was a failed attempt. Anyway, so going back to the refugee trip, after they made contact, they kind of realized we're just refugees, because I think our ship was painted in military colors to try and deceive any sort of pirates, but that didn't. So it didn't work. No. So they realized we were a refugee boat. And then not long later, we were surrounded by, I don't know, I think mum said like 6 or 12 or something. Like we were surrounded. I don't know exactly, but we're surrounded by these boats. And they just basically boarded us, robbed everyone on board. My mum said they even took a few of the women onto their boat. I don't know what happened after that. I think my mum said they ruined the engine. My auntie said they pushed my mum at one point, and she almost fell into this hole in the boat, like kind of like into the engine bay or something. Like she must, and my auntie was quick enough to kind of save her, like just grab onto her before she fell. And I guess luckily they didn't kill us, and they just kind of left us. I believe they left us with a broken engine or something so the boat couldn't go anywhere, and we were just floating. And I think later on another boat came by, and they were a bit more friendly, and they helped us out, I believe. This is all kind of what my mum's told me, and helped us maybe fix the engine and point us, you know, in the right direction. Gave us rations too, because I remember at one point we started eating. Oh, well, I remember, like, you know, congee, fish congee. I remember like really fishy congee. Eating that, and so we were on our way, and I think we eventually made it to Malaysia, and that was a nice moment, you know, hitting the beach, and then it's almost like once you get there, I remember that first night we got there, my mum and my aunties were like, you know, catching up with people that they may have even known back in Vietnam who had made it, you know, into the camp, whereas us kids, we were like, we were so tired. I think we just fell asleep at the table.
I'm sitting on the edge of my seat, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, you'd be crying as soon as you laugh, because of sense of like, you know, we made it. We didn't die. We got over the line to arrive in Malaysia.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's, you know, the fact that my mum and my parent, my dad and aunties all kind of went on this trip, even though my mum had already lost siblings on a previous trip. I think a few years earlier they went, and no sign was heard from them, so they were presumed drowned at sea. And yeah, like, it's, you know, it kind of goes to show maybe at that point in time how bad the situation was in Vietnam how bad the prospects for the future was for people, that they were going to, yeah, this was worth it, even though it was risking life and death. And talking to my mum nowadays, she said, yeah, it's hard to believe that she made that decision back then, but she probably forgot how bad it was.
He recognizes that things could have turned out completely different than how they did, and he's eternally grateful that they had the opportunity to start anew in Australia.
It's one of those moments where it's like a sliding doors moment, right, where your parents made a decision one way or the other, and that, I think, affected our lives tremendously. We had, you know, after coming to Australia, plenty of opportunities here, peaceful country, love, you know, people are great. Growing up with lots of opportunities to be successful in life, I think those opportunities would have been very much diminished back in Vietnam, and you see that when you go back, kind of, you know, how hard our life can be in Vietnam, yes. And a lot of it depends on kind of the family that you're born into, in a way. So yeah, it's like if you're a, you know, brilliant and great, like, you know, very, very capable. Your opportunities are obviously a lot less in Vietnam compared to Australia.
after arriving in Malaysia. His mother and the other refugees were given a choice to some degree of where to migrate to. Australia, the US, and Canada were all possibilities, and it was the pool of family that brought them to Australia.
Fewer like women and children sort of group, like me, my sisters and my aunties were, you kind of get high priority than if you're a single male sort of thing. We had an uncle who went before us. They chose us. I think they got sponsored over by an Australian couple or something to Australia. So they came over to Australia a few years before. And so we decided we would follow him, I guess. My mum, I think my mum had a choice maybe even America or even Canada, but she decided to go to Australia with this uncle. So then it was a case of just getting the paperwork processed, and they would just then, they would just fly us. Like once everything was done, they'd fly us from Malaysia to Australia. So that part of the journey was nice. I still remember my son being on a plane. It's like, you probably see it as a kid. You expect to walk up to the plane and look at and climb up the ladder. But I think it was one of those, the passageway that you don't really get to see the plane. Yeah, I remember sitting down on the seat and asking Mum, are we on the plane? Like I wasn't sure. Like I thought the expectations were different. So yeah, that was very uneventful. Like just coming to Australia by plane was just normal.
After living through so many changes already in his short life, Lam arrived in Australia at the age of 7 and went into school at the end of year 2.
We lived in Marrickville at the time. I think we pretty much lived with our uncle. I don't think we were allowed to, because I remember when the landlord lady came around to collect rent, we would all have to hide while we went to the door and paid the landlord. But eventually we got a flat. My mum and auntie rented a flat in Marrickville, and I went to Marrickville West Public at the time. First 3, so year 2, year 3, and year 4. So that would have been about 88, around then, yeah.
Starting school in a new country where everything was new and different certainly isn't easy, especially for a young refugee who doesn't speak the local language.
Yeah, it was a big, I guess, shock in a way. First day of school, I remember that, not speaking the language at all, not really understanding what everyone is saying. That was quite hard in a way. I was in a class where there was a girl who spoke Cantonese, and they got her to kind of show me around the first day or so, and that was really nice. Yeah. I think the school knew that we were refugees or obviously because we were coming in midterm and didn't speak a word of English. but I remember initially probably the first, few months, just being a bit lonely because I didn't have many friends. I think the language barrier would have, and also coming in midterm, right, there would have been established friendship groups even at year 2. And so I do remember times where I was just walking around the playground by myself, a bit bored, a bit sad. But I think by about year 3, I had formed friends. I had met, had some good friends who I then, we played at lunchtime. I was in ESL for about a year, I think. So all of year 2 and then year 3 as well. And I think as my English got better and I started to kind of fit into the culture here, and yeah, it just felt normal. It's not a unique story in that when I read Ando's book about how he came over, very similar. And I think for a lot of Vietnamese Australians, that it's all very there. It's a very common story that gets told around people around kind of my age, around that time.
The transitions didn't end there, as Lam's family moved around Sydney several times, starting from the end of primary school. They moved from Marrickville to Greenacre, where he attended the selective Sefton High.
At the time, the whole selective process wasn't probably as big it is nowadays, or as competitive. But that was an interesting experience. It was a bit of a shock in that, I would do quite well I was doing quite well in primary school in terms of academics, and then going to a selective school where you kind of see how academically great everyone was. And it was a big moment. I remember the first test where I failed, and it was like, wow. Okay, I'm not as clever as I thought I was. And it was a grounding moment. I went to school in Sefton. Then my parents moved again. So we spent about 5 years living in Mount Druitt from about year 10 to about third year uni. So moved around Sydney a fair bit.
Do you know why parents continue to move around Sydney?
I think Marrickville to Greenacre was kind of, they went from a flat to a house. So they worked quite hard to save up. And I think at the time the interest rates were bloody expensive too. Like they went a lot higher than it was today. So they would, my mum would say, yeah, they would work long hours doing kind of work that's sewing basic. So, you know, piece work. So every garment they sew, they get like 20 cents or something. And so they'd save them enough where they bought a house in Greenacre. And I think the move from Greenacre to Mount Druitt was kind of a bit of a split between my mum and my auntie. Probably argument of some sort, and they kind of wanted to go separate ways. And they didn't have, when they sold the house in Greenacre, they didn't have enough to buy back in Greenacre, so they had to go further out west. And the only place we could afford was out in Mount Druitt, so we lived out there. And Mount Druitt was very different from what it is today. It was pretty rough back then. So the travel from Mount Druitt to high school to Sefton was quite a trek every morning, and eventually even to uni, you know, all the way to the city, that was quite a trek.
By the end of year 12, Lam wasn't sure what he wanted to study at university. He chose to focus on an area that interested him, which was computers.
I picked computer engineering, computer systems engineering at UTS, and I managed to just scrape in, I think. My TER just got me into that course based on the previous year's cutoff. that's what I did for it. It was a sandwich course, actually. So meaning that you had to do like full time semesters of study followed by full time semesters of work, which was industry experience, they call it, and it's what you had to find. So it's just like sandwiching work with study, so that by the end of five and a half years, you could come out and say that you've got 1.5 years of industrial experience. So it's only a 4-year degree. And that sounded good at the time. Yeah, it has its positives and negatives too, I think. It is a long time to be in uni, be studying. And I think you had companies where even though you came out with industrial experience, they, in terms of, let's say, paying you a certain salary, they would say, well, that doesn't really count because that's like, that's like work experience. That's not, industry experience. And so there was a little bit of that, I think. And so friends who did computer science, that was only like a 3-year degree. By the time I graduated, they'd already had 3 years of work experience, right? And they would be on much higher wages and things like that. So you felt like, oh God, I spent 6 years doing this and I came out and I'm just a graduate type thing.
During his studies, he learned that he had an interest in the biomedical technology side of computers, which is using technology in the medical field.
So I did a sub-major at UTS on biomedical technology. And when I graduated, I got a job at ResMed. It's a relatively big Australian medical device company. And pretty much my career, like that was, and ever since then, I was pretty much always in the medical devices industry. So I went from like ResMed to, I think, Ventricor at one stage, after ResMed, and then Cochlear. That's a bit later.
Lam was keen to see more of the world and explore it on his own terms after he graduated from university.
I did what most people around my age at that time were doing, which was going to like spend a couple of years in London on a working holiday visa. So that's exactly what I did. After my stint at Ventricor, I think I was in my mid-20s at the time, decided, well, actually, no, probably a little more late 20s. It was like, kind of seen enough of Sydney and gone a bit bored, decided to do what my friends were all kind of doing. And so we all went over there and just kind of worked and traveled as much of Europe as we could. It was a bit difficult because, in London, it was very finance orientated. So it was quite hard to kind of get a job that was high paying without that prior finance experience. So I think my travels would have been a lot better if I'd gotten like a contracting role in London. But I'd end up getting a consultancy kind of permanent role with a consultant house. The pay wasn't as good, which means we couldn't travel as much, but you know, it was an amazing experience in terms of like for the first time living away from home, just feeling like really independent and feeling like an adult in my late 20s.
Turning to property, he admits that investment wasn't always on his radar, although he found himself with an investment property somewhat unwillingly. He acknowledges that it was one of the best things that he could have happened to him.
I guess when I was younger, I didn't really have that much of an interest in property. And I think my mum and my uncle, who was interested in property investment, they kind of pushed me to buy an investment property kind of around 2005, before we went over to London. And it was just an oldish and quite an old rundown house in Punchbowl. Renovated it a bit and rented it out. And I really had no interest because I guess at that point in my life, I was just wanting to have fun, go out. I didn't want to have a mortgage debt at that point. So in a way, my start in property investment was very reluctant and had to be pushed. I think everyone, as you grow older, your mindset changes, right? And so at that age, I probably wasn't ready. But I did anyway. But because I had a job, I was able to get a loan and bought that property. Didn't do much of it with it, apart from just doing a reno and rented it out, and just kind of left it as is whilst we were in London. And it wasn't until we came back from London when we were decided. So I went with my girlfriend at the time, and then we got engaged and we came back to Australia to thank you. Get married and I guess settle down, because by that stage we were kind of late 20s, like early 30s, we're thinking about starting a family and all that. It wasn't until we came back that I really started thinking seriously about property investment. Even when we came back, so even after we came back from London, we bought an apartment in the city, because it was close to everything. We didn't have kids at the time, obviously. We just wanted to, a great location. So we bought a one bedder in Chippendale and we lived there.
It wasn't until they had their first child that they realized their home was no longer large enough for them. With space in mind, they decided to head out to the Hills District.
And then I think around that time is when I had our first daughter, that it kind of, what was more, the things that were important to me changed, obviously. Family became more of a focus, and kind of, future, wealth and, security and all that sort of thing. And that kind of led me from a full-time, it led me away from working in a full-time job to wanting to invest more and to seek wealth via other means. So that's when the property stuff really started kicking off. It was I think it was 2012 was when I had a big, and it's interesting because I kind of got the inspiration from my mum and what she did with her place in Sefton at the time. She had a house on a corner block and she built a granny flat at the back, and that allowed her to rent out the front. And I saw that concept and I'm thinking, this is really good. Like if I buy an investment property that's on a corner and I'm able to build a granny flat at the back and rent it out, and you can rent it out for good money in Sydney, particularly one that's on a corner block where it's got its own side entrance, you can design it such that it's like a little house in itself, right? So for an extra, at the time initially it was only like 120k. The prices went up over time, to up to maybe 150, but even that's not that much. For an extra 100-150k to get an extra $300-400 back in rent for that entire property kind of made it a very good deal. You couldn't get that sort of returns anywhere. So what I ended up doing was I sold the punch bowl place because it wasn't on a corner and the front, I wasn't getting enough returns on it. So I basically sold that and bought a place in Chester Hill straight away with kind of, yeah. And then in that kind of 5 year period between 2012 to 2017, I was just accumulating as much as I could on that strategy of just buying corner blocks, and doing exactly that, like building a granny flat and, you know, also renovating the front house and then just kind of do like a refinance after everything was done to kind of pull out the equity that I'd put in and the deposit and then move on to the next one.
He was lucky in that during that time, property prices were increasing. As a result, he was able to keep rolling and accumulated 4 investment properties in Sydney over a 5 year period.
I considered investing in other states at the time as well, but it was just, for this strategy, I guess, to work, I wanted to be more intimate and involved in the granny flat builds. And it was always going to be harder to do that interstate. So it was a case of, well, yeah, you know, just do it as local as I can. I remember at the time I had like, I was doing all this kind of whilst I was working as well. So I remember I was using real estate and I had to find these corner blocks, which wasn't easy. So I had all these, I got like a list of the postcodes in Sydney. I was then able to kind of create searches on realestate.com that can give me alerts. I was searching for keywords like corner, but only in Sydney area. And yeah, and so that kind of helped a lot in narrowing down the kind of the properties that I'd shortlist. And I'd then use Google Maps and I'd check out their backyard to see how big they are. And I'd measure the distances to kind of see, oh yeah, that's possible. You know, you can probably put a granny flat in that. So I had like certain criteria that needed to be met before I would even then go and look at the property. Yeah. So there needed to be a way to automate some of that to make it manageable. A lot of weekend work, a lot of after hours work. Yeah. But it was interesting. Like it was, you know, because you're building your future, it didn't feel like work. Well, it was work, but I was driven because of that.
Liam was on a roll in 2017. In the 5 years before that, he'd purchased 4 investment properties and had found that getting finance for his property dreams was an easy and straightforward process. However, something rolled along and put a stone in his spokes.
APRA stepped in and just made it a lot harder. We were kind of, I guess we got to a point where we kind of had to stop in 2017 because we couldn't get any more financing. Partially due to APRA, partially probably, you know, due to the fact that we had that many loans. it's a case of if I'd been more picky in some of the properties, it would have taken longer, first of all. It would have taken more time to find these properties. I would have maybe gone further, you know what I mean? But I wasn't super picky in that. As soon as we had the funds and as soon as I found a property and I had a spreadsheet to calculate whether or not it was worth buying and at what price, that was the important thing. I had to calculate at what price it was going to be neutrally geared or slightly positively geared after the granny flat was built and after the renos and you know there's a lot of error involved because I'm predicting how much rent I'll be getting and everything but it was all in that spreadsheet kind of then and then allowed me to kind of go to the auctions with a level of confidence as to how much I wanted to bid so that helped.
The strategy he implemented was relatively simple, making an easy process for him. When the tides began to turn in 2017, suddenly APRA wasn't the only thing rocking the boat.
I was fairly well prepared in terms of, you know, I said, I had kind of the set prices, so I was never going to overpay. Although that last property, I was very, very doubtful. The last one that we bought at the peak. We bought in 2017, and that was probably past the peak, I'd say, and that was on its way down even. We were umming and ahhing about whether to buy it, but I figured, look, we were at the end of our accumulation because I knew by that stage that this would probably be the last. I don't think we'd be able to get more finance. The auction was a very strange one in that it was only me and this other person that was bidding. And we I used a very kind of aggressive bidding strategy, whereas I would just bid quickly and try not to give the other party much time to think about their next bid type thing, or put pressure on them in a way. So we got up to a point, it had stopped, and I'd reached my limit. And I'd said, okay, well, that's it. I'm done. I told the agent I was done. But the agent managed to kind of convince me to go an extra 1,000, right? So I was like, all right, I'll put an extra 1,000 in. And then the other party got super angry. They got really upset. They were like, what is this? Like, I had it and now you're... Anyway, he stormed off. And then that kind of got me suspicious. I'm thinking, whoa. Like, is this guy being paid by the agent? You know, like, am I being stitched up here? Yeah, to push this price to a point where the other party just stormed off. So,
somewhat stunned, Lamb ended up taking the deal, but the drama was far from over.
And then after that, there was even further issues we had with the financing, because the property that I bought had a corner shop attached to it, right? And so the loan that we ended up getting could not be a simple residential loan. It had to be commercial, but commercial wasn't gonna work either for some reason. I can't remember now. The broker had issues with it, so I ended up having to go with not a top tier lender, but I had to go with Liberty, second tier lender who was able to do these sort of riskier loans, I suppose. But the rates were higher, so I guess a lesson learned there would be maybe a bit more research. I kind of went into that not really. And so we're not paying a high rate. You could argue we were kind of paying top dollar for that property. I saw potential in it because I saw that it could, the shop, if it was successful, if the person that was running the shop was successful, then I believe the amount of returns we could get from the property would be high. So that was pretty much the only saving grace. Like I wouldn't even pay anywhere near that sort of figure if it didn't have a shop attached to it. So, but yeah, it came with its issues, and yeah, that's probably a learning experience is to know about those things in advance.
As the property was on a corner block, it fitted his template of being able to accommodate a granny flat. Last but certainly not least, the shop was the icing on the cake.
So what's happened with that property ever since is now we've got a good tenant in there and they are running a business out of that. The lease we have in it is an all-in-one lease, meaning it's so the people that are living in the house is also running the business. So we just have a residential lease. So we don't have three incomes, so to speak. The rent is higher, is a little bit higher, but it's not anywhere near like if you had, a commercial lease and then, yeah, it's – but look, we don't know what the future would hold with it, but I'm hoping the business, their business is successful and we can share in that success, I suppose. Because that interest rate was so high, that property has always kind of always been teetering on neutrally geared to negatively geared. Whereas the other ones were a bit easier to become positive. It just makes it easier to hold, right?
He's since gone back to refinance the most recent purchase. And while today the interest rate remains high, it hasn't deterred him from his dream one bit.
I guess it goes back quite a way to kind of when I started like property investing. It was really a goal to not be working in a full-time job for the rest of my career. The initial plan was to use property as a way to generate wealth. And over time, with the capital growth, I'd then be able to step back from my work. So over the course of started investing in 2012, but I kind of went part-time in about 2017 or so. I quit my job at ResMed because I joined them again in a second stint after coming back from London. I quit my job there because they weren't able to offer a part-time role, and I joined up with Cochlear, and they were able to give me a part-time role there. So yeah, that was great. So then I was able to continue kind of doing this, and just at that time I also started the side hustle. So I've always been kind of thinking, like I just wanted to do this more than I wanted to work the previous role. So. And I guess over time with the capital growth, definitely that's helped. Although, it's it's capital growth, but we haven't really kind of taken any sort of, you know, we haven't refinanced after the original refinance. So if we're just letting the loan to value ratio drop and it becoming, yeah, as the rent slowly rose over time, becoming a slightly more positively geared. So that's, the properties provide a little bit of extra income a year, not a huge amount, I think. Most of its value is in the locked in equity. But yeah, just then switching over to like concentrating more on the side hustle, which eventually turned into a side business, eventually turning into a full-time business. That kind of gave me the opportunity to completely quit.
It got to a stage where he was happy with the income from it. That, along with his wife's full-time job, gave him the resolve to step away.
That is an awesome security blanket. Having at least one partner kind of making that full-time wage. And then, yeah, and so I was able to do that, I suppose, able to quit completely. I think it was 2019. So a couple of years after the last property that we just, and also around 2017, we also invested in a company, Tesla. that you might have heard of. It was all after reading a book on Elon Musk, actually. I read the biography by Ashley Vance because I'd seen some articles online about, you know, this, because I heard about this guy probably even back in London days, about this guy doing an electric vehicle. Look, my mind wasn't really much in the share market at the time or anything, investing anything at the time, so I didn't pursue it. But by 2017, I was, you know, obviously on the lookout for, I had more time as well. That's the other thing. Like not working that extra day gives you so much time to explore opportunities that I'd missed, you know, because previously I was just too busy working 5 days a week and I was knackered by the weekend and I just wanted to enjoy my weekend. It's the opportunity cost, I think, is very important here. Working part-time is just, yeah, the best. So I was able to kind of explore that opportunity after reading the book and just kind of being, oh, it's really interesting, you know, what he's achieved at that time, by that time, 2017. I was comfortable enough to put a decent chunk of money in the company, in the stock market. And that's kind of like our biggest investment at that point in terms of the stock market. We never really were too big into the stock market. And that's done quite well. Obviously over the years, as the company's grown, we've added to our position in that. So I think that's also contributed to being able to have the freedom of time now. It's not like we can just drop everything now. We're not in a position where we can just drop everything and say we're retired and not have to work at all. We still have, you know, living expenses to pay for and we, you know, mortgages to pay. So I don't think we've hit FIRE yet.
FIRE is an acronym for Financial Independence Retire Early. Lam was new to it himself and it stumbled across him more so than the other way around.
The host of the Aussie Firebug, Matt, I think his name was, I can't remember. He must have seen the article that it all goes back to the article that my friend wrote. I had a friend who's the editor of at the ABC for a column on, I think it was parenting and, you know, work life balance and that sort of stuff. And so he wanted to share my story about how I went from a full time job to being kind of, you know, like almost like a stay-at-home dad in a way, but, you know, but part-time being the primary carer is probably more accurate, being a primary carer of my kids, which was fairly uncommon. Mostly you see women kind of doing that role. So he wanted to share that story on the ABC. So he wrote an article about that. And Matt, I think on his forums, so some of his members would have seen that article and posted it up and had some comments, and Matt invited me onto that podcast. So I did a podcast with them and I believe that's how you found me.
He's well on his way to his goal of having enough cash flow to cover everything life throws his way. Something he admires Aussie Firebug Matt for.
He posts on his blog kind of his net worth and how his investments have been going since forever. And how you don't actually need that much money to hit FIRE as long as your expenses are not extravagant. So that's quite an interesting concept, and I wasn't really aware of that. Younger. So I kind of went about my way of doing it. It's a similar concept of about freeing up your time to use your time in ways that is more valuable to you, I guess. Because look, working a full time job is great for some people. I think they love it, and then that's it's great for them. But for, I think for a lot of other people as well, it's not what they want to do either. Trying to reach financial independence is a good goal to have, I guess.
Recognizing and reaching for your goal is one of Lam's top pieces of advice. Knowing why that's your goal is just as important, if not more so.
You got to really step back and kind of look at what are you doing all this for, you know? And I think as you get older, the question becomes louder and louder in your mind as to, well, why am I doing all this? It's got to be for a reason. And then you kind of assess what's important to you in life, and you got to prioritize those things and trying to do more of the important stuff, I guess.
Lam considers his granny flat revelation to be his biggest aha moment, as he helped to pave the path that many others walk on today.
Back then when I was doing it, I don't think it was as prominent. I don't think as many people, there were people doing it, okay? There were people building granny flats, but I was aiming specifically for corner blocks where I would do it up so that it's like a little house. I think that makes it very, that's a big advantage in terms of getting it rented out. I know you can have like private access on a normal block, and that's better than nothing. But I think a corner block just makes it so much nicer. So the aha moment was, you know, like, wow, like putting in 150K, 100 to 150K, and getting back an extra $400-$500 in rent. Wow. And that allows me then to just keep going. Like, I can just refinance that and just move on to the next one. That was all until APRA shut it down.
Even with 100-150K, you can even borrow that, couldn't you? You know, through the equity that you built up.
That probably would have been the smart way to do it. I didn't do it that way. I kind of used personal funds, personal savings to do the build, and then kind of refinanced. Yeah, I mean, there were obviously, yeah, there would have been things that I probably would have done again. If I did it again, I'd probably change. I'll probably try and borrow the funds instead of using personal equity.
Turning back to recognizing your why, Lam reveals his own.
Well, I think it's pretty much doing it so that we can spend more time with our kids. I've got a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old at the moment. And yeah, I mean, the reason why we're doing all this is just so that whilst they're still young and whilst they still want to be with their parents and go out with their parents, we want to... that's our aim. Obviously our aim is to try and get it such that my wife doesn't need to work her full-time job if she doesn't want to. I mean, she's very happy there at the moment. It's nice to have that option, right? That's what's kind of important. And I think moving forward even further, like into the future, it's almost like if you're happy once you've achieved your goal, then what's your next goal? What do you do then? I think maybe philanthropy later, if that becomes an option, is probably super long term at the moment.
His mum and uncle definitely gave him the first push to buy an investment property, and it could have ended there if he chose to. The investment bug had bitten him hard though, and he was keen to soak up as much information as he could.
I remember attending various property, I guess they'd be workshops, although they it was always presented, there's always a money-making thing behind it, like as in, yeah, there's always the courses that you could sign up and that was to learn. I think that was just to learn about the whole adding value to a property once you've purchased it to increase the returns. Another thing, I found the online forums a really great place. Like I'm a member of Property Chat. It's a great place to kind of learn about property investment. And I remember this was a while ago as well, where when I was reading a book by, I think it was Steve McKnight, about positive cash flow, positive properties or something like that. And that was quite interesting. Like I didn't, I didn't realize that you could, at the time, that you could buy a property and it would pay you more than you could, you know, pay you back more than what the loan could, the interest you'd be charged on. But I think over the years I've learned it's a case of usually those properties, the potential for capital growth isn't as high as if you, and so I think it opened my eyes in that sort of respect. But I went the other way, didn't I? I went and I bought a place in, you know, bought properties in Sydney, which was not great for cash flow, but had much higher potential growth. And I think that was probably the right decision. I'm not sure. I mean, I say that, but then, you know, there are people out there with 100 properties who are, you know, making a ton of money. So they probably made the right decision. I've always wondered how they, you know, it's very interesting how they do that. Like I think you make your money when you buy it. You know, like they say, you basically find a good deal that works out fantastically, and it's time consuming to do, actually. And that's what I meant earlier when I said I could have probably been a bit more picky, right, in terms of choosing my properties, where I really just jumped into it because time was of the essence, I guess. I think those people who were able to accumulate large portfolios, they bought really well. And they must have had a lot of good connections and a lot of time and whatnot to kind of buy those properties, which fantastic returns, and just keep rolling. And even with APRA and everything, they were not stopped in that. They were able to continue servicing their loans. So that's great. Like, if you know, I think that's like elite level property investing.
He understands that even the people with the largest property portfolios hit a ceiling at one point or another, and has wisely diversified his assets as a result.
At one stage, all our eggs were in one basket, so to speak, in that all our assets were in Sydney properties. And then we diversified into the stock market with Tesla, so now all our eggs are in two baskets. So it's a case of, I don't know what the future holds in terms of property investment for us. I don't know if we will accumulate more. I'm not sure. That's certainly a possibility. Or do we then invest in other companies? Because I've learned a fair bit in the last few years about not property investment, but like more on kind of the investing in companies that have good growth potential, solid growth prospects that are not super risky, I suppose. So that's been a bit of a learning experience for me, because when I was younger, I was always told that the stock market was a gambling house, and I don't believe that anymore. I think there are things you can do on the stock market that are kind of gambling, like short-term trading is a little bit, it's risky because of the price fluctuations. It's hard to predict, right? Whereas I think it's easier to predict long-term trends and where companies are well positioned. And if you're willing to wait, and it's kind of like property investment, it's a long-term investment. If you're willing to, if you see like the potential and you see a path there, it's a bit easier to predict. Everything comes with risk, but I think it's less risky. The Sydney property has done fantastic over the last 10 years because, Sydney's a great place to live. There's a lot of demand. We have population growth. If all those things change, it could go the other way. It's unlikely. I think it's very unlikely for that to happen, but and that's why we were happy at the time to put all our eggs in one basket, because of all those things: population growth, fantastic place to live in, infrastructure was growing.
If you met yourself, say, 10 years ago, what would you have said to him?
Start earlier in investing, I think, would be the – but I'm sure 10 years – me 10 years ago would not listen to that advice. I was like, no, not important. But, yeah, it's always a case of, if I'd bought earlier, then, geez, I would have picked up a lot of cheaper properties. But there's a time and a place, I think. I always kind of step back and think, it just wasn't ready at the time. And that's the case with a lot of people. When you're young, you're not ready to think about that stuff.
Hindsight, it's always a good thing, isn't it? Well, I guess in the future, you kind of already touched on it as well too. You're interested in, I guess, looking at diversifying at the moment. But what are you most excited, I guess, in your journey over, say, the next 5 years?
I'm hoping we reach our goal of reaching complete financial independence where we can. So that would look like, say, for example, if my wife would choose to do so, probably not working a full-time job maybe, and she would probably spend a bit more time with our girls. That's something that could possibly change in the next 5 years. I could probably I think I still run my business. So my business has a philanthropic component to it, where every sale we make, we donate a portion of our profits to a charity of the customer's choice. I've always liked to tie business success with kind of social responsibility and kind of give back to the community. I think that's important. And I think, you know, this is probably, you know, really like pie in the sky vision, where if one day maybe the business can just be giving all profits to charity, that'll be fantastic. If I don't need that money for personal use, then why not? Then it comes down to how much time I want to spend on the business, or if I want to let someone else run the business, perhaps. If we can get there in 5 years' time, that'd be fantastic. If I could, you know, if our investments have reached a point where we can just have the business donate more to charity, that would be great. Or even be more picky maybe choosing some of the charities or supporting more local causes. That'd be awesome. I mean, I don't know. I think it's quite a lofty goal.
Well, gee, you've achieved quite a lot. You know, your property journey has been so inspiring. I've learned so much as well just from hearing your story. How much of it do you think has been, you know, your success due to skill, intelligence, hard work, and how much of it do you think has been due to luck?
I think it's a bit of both. I think perseverance, being driven in kind of what you want your future to be, is part of it. So putting in the hard yards is important, having the right strategy. But I also believe, we kind of got lucky in a way, in that we started buying properties around the time where properties were going up. You know, we started in 2012. That's when it kind of started to lift off in Sydney, and during that period. So I guess that part of it was luck. You have to put yourself in the game, though. You can't just, you know, step back and not make decisions. And I think that's important, in that you need to have actions. With your goals, you just little things, even if it's doing a little thing, a little bit a day. If your work day is busy, just do a little bit of a day, a little bit each day to reach that goal. Then that's important. And we kind of got lucky too with that Tesla investment too, with, you know, how the company has done fantastically since 2017. But once again, you got to be in the game. So to answer that question, it's a bit of both. I think it's hard work. You know, thinking of the right strategies, being focused and doing it and following that strategy. And then, yeah, luck is luck. Lucky, you don't know. if you get it, that's great. It's one of those things.
Thank you to Chi Lam, our guest on this episode of Property Investory.